Mahabharata, Chapter 51, Into Position. Early the next morning, Yudhisthira made his final preparations. His spies had reported to him everything that had taken place in Duryodhana's tent the previous evening. Anxiously, he said to Arjuna, "You have heard how Bhishma claims he can slay our army in 1 month. Drona has said the same. All the Kaurava heroes have stated their determination. Karna even suggested that he could defeat the armies in 5 days. Tell me, O Phalguni, how long do you think it would take you to kill them?" Arjuna glanced across at Krishna. "The Kuru warriors are all high-minded heroes who are expert in wielding weapons. But do not be anxious, dear brother. Our enemies will not have the chance to slay us. I say truly that with Krishna's aid I can uproot the 3 worlds in a moment. I possess Shiva's personal weapon, which alone is capable of annihilating the creation. None of the Kauravas know this weapon. Of course, it would not be proper for me to use it against them, but there will be no need. We shall gain victory by the mere strength of our arms." Arjuna indicated the many kings present with a sweep of his hand. "Besides me, you have numerous heroes on your side. By ranging among the enemy ranks in our chariots, we will soon cause great destruction. Of course, we also have you, O king. Surely, whoever you cast your angry glance upon will immediately be consumed like dry leaves in a fire. I do not see how the Kauravas can win this war." Comforted, Yudhisthira continued to arrange for the first day's battle. His commander surrounded him, clad in armor. All had been purified by sacred rituals and had bestowed wealth upon the Brahmins. With their ornamented swords swinging by their sides, they left the tent one by one to lead their respective divisions into position. The early morning sun rose to reveal the vast Kurukshetra field covered by the 2 armies. They seemed like 2 great oceans drawn against one another. The sound of the armies filled the heavens like the low rumbling of clouds in the autumn. When everything had been finalized, Yudhisthira himself left the tent, followed by his brothers and Krishna. On all sides they saw cheerful troops preparing their weapons and chariots. As the Pandavas and Krishna mounted their cars, crowds of Brahmins praised Yudhisthira and offered prayers to Krishna. According to their battle plan, the Pandava army arranged and rearranged itself in different formations, moving their leading warriors about the field and confounding the Kauravas. In response, the Kauravas also moved their divisions about in various ways, so that the Pandavas would not easily see their plan of attack. As the 2 immense armies maneuvered around the field, a huge dust cloud rose into the sky, screening the morning sun. Thousands of elephants made the earth vibrate as they moved across the field, resembling dark clouds. The formations of chariot fighters, with their polished golden cars, seemed in contrast to the elephant divisions, like clusters of brilliant luminaries in the night sky. Behind both armies, their encampments stretched for miles, looking with their rows of tents and shops like 2 large towns. They were bustling with cooks, servants, and tradespeople going about their business. All the warriors had left for the battle, which would last until sunset. Gradually, the 2 armies closed on each other. Hundreds of thousands of conches filled the air with their blasts. The beating of drums and blowing of trumpets created a cacophony of sound which mixed with the elephants' majestic cries. Countless banners fluttered from chariots, appearing like waves of bright colors amid the assembled troops. The commanders of the 2 sides met to agree on the rules of battle. Warriors should only fight with equals and with equal weapons. None should strike another without warning, but should first challenge him. One who surrendered or one fleeing from the fight should never be struck down. The many servants on the battlefield carrying weapons and other paraphernalia were not to be killed. The commander spoke for some time. When all the rules had been established, Drishtadyumna became thoughtful. Duryodhana and his henchmen had never shown much regard for righteousness. Why would they now observe rules especially if the battle was not going their way. As Bhishma and his generals were about to leave, Jishtadyumna voiced his doubts. "We will respect these stipulations, but I make one provision. If the Kauravas forget our agreement and fight without respect for the rules, then we too shall adapt whatever tactics we deem appropriate. We will not, however, be the first to break the conditions." "So be it," Bhishma replied. He took his leave from Jishtadyumna, and the warriors returned to their positions to prepare for the start of the battle, which would be signaled by both commanders-in-chief blowing their conch shells. Dhritarashtra sat anxiously in his palace. There was nothing he could do now but wait. Wanting to share his feelings with someone, and missing the association of Vidura, the old king called for Sanjaya and said, "Tell me what is now happening, O Sanjaya. Have the two armies reached Kurukshetra? Destiny is more powerful than all of a man's endeavors. Even though I tried to restrain my son, aware as I am of the horrors of war, I was unsuccessful. Why was that, O wise Sanjaya? Although I can see Duryodhan's folly, still I have not been able to stop him. Surely this war has been divinely ordained. Besides, it is always honorable for a Kshatriya to die in battle." Sanjaya felt he did not have much more to say. He had tried many times to point out how the blame for the disaster facing the Kurus rested not only with Duryodhan, but with the king himself. Yet the king seemed unable to admit it. "O king, surely a man who meets with calamities as a result of his own acts should not blame either the gods, destiny, or others. Each one of us receives the just results of our actions. O leader of the Kurus, you have failed to act virtuously. The Pandavas have borne your son's persecution, always hoping that you would deliver justice in the end, but you have not done so. Now all that is left is for you to hear of the Kuru heroes being slaughtered." As Sanjaya spoke, Vyasadeva suddenly entered the chamber. The Rishi, who could see past, present, and future, said, "O great king, your sons and all the other kings have now arrived at the end of their lives. They have assembled for battle and will all kill one another. Remembering the changes that are inevitably brought about by time, do not grieve. O child, if you wish to see the battle, I will give you the ability." Dhritarashtra sighed, "I do not desire to see my sons die, O great sage. Simply let me hear of the battle." "Then I shall bestow the ability to see upon Sanjaya," Vyasadeva replied. "By my grace, he will be able to see everything that takes place at Kurukshetra. With celestial vision, he will see even things that are concealed and all that happens at night. He will feel no exhaustion for the duration of the war. As for victory, that will occur wherever there is righteousness. Regardless of who wins, however, you should know that almost all the warriors on both sides will be slain. This is what the omens say." Vyasadeva described the portents, earthly and celestial, which predicted destruction. Thousands of carnivorous birds were alighting on treetops, crying in glee. Herons, uttering harsh cries, were flying toward the south. The sun was screened by three-colored clouds at both twilights. In temples, the images of gods perspired and trembled, and sometimes dropped from their positions. All this indicates a great slaughter. Many heroic kings will sleep forever, embracing the earth as if she were a lover. Vyasadeva also described how the planets were aligned in malefic formations. After speaking for some time, he concluded, "Know that these signs point toward an annihilation of the Kshatriyas. There can be no doubt." Dhritarashtra lifted his face toward the Rishi. "Surely this war has been divinely ordained. O sage, will not all the Kshatriyas attain the regions reserved for heroes, thereby experiencing unending happiness? By giving up their lives in battle, certainly they will achieve fame in this life and joy in the next." Vyasadeva did not answer immediately. He He concentrated his mind in meditation and then replied, "Time destroys the universe and all its creatures. Nothing in this world lasts forever. Only virtue lasts, along with the soul, when all else has been destroyed. Therefore, point your sons to the right path. All of you should follow Krishna's will. That eternal being has personally shown virtue's proper course, but you did not accept it. The slaughter of men, especially kinsmen, could never produce good. The Vedas always condemn it. You are still able to prevent what is about to transpire, my son, but you do not because you are attached to the kingdom. Your virtue is quickly fading. You have allowed your son, who has been born as death personified for your family, to lead the Kurus to ruin." Dhritarashtra hung his head as his father continued to criticize him in strong words, his voice breaking the still silence of the empty chamber. "What is the value of a kingdom gained through sin and earning only sin, O king? Protect your good name and virtue. You will then be able to attain heaven. Let the Pandavas have their kingdom, and let the Kurus have peace." Dhritarashtra was embarrassed before the sage. His pathetic voice pleaded in reply, "O Rishi of immeasurable power, your words are without fault. I also know what you know. Please believe that I am not inclined toward sin. My sons will not obey me. I have tried my best. Do not forsake me. You are able to protect my fame and virtue. See me as an ordinary man whose intentions are good, but whose power is limited. O Great One, you are the respected grandfather of all the Kurus. Be gracious to me." Vyasadeva could understand that there was nothing more he could do to help the Kurus. He stood up to leave. "O King, I am leaving. Is there any last thing you desire to hear from me?" "Yes, there is one more thing. What signs portend victory for an army?" The king still hoped that somehow his sons might emerge victorious. He wanted to know if there were any indications of it. After all, the Kaurava forces were almost twice the Pandavas. Vyasadeva told him which omens indicate victory. Understanding Dhritarashtra's mind, he said, "The size of an army is of little consequence. Indeed, a large army which is broken and routed is difficult to regroup. More important is the courage and camaraderie of the soldiers. Even 50 well-trained men who do not retreat and who know each other well can defeat an entire army. Victory in any battle is always uncertain. Therefore, it is always superior to negotiate for peace. The result obtained by negotiation is best. That obtained by disunion is indifferent, and that obtained by war is the worst. Even the victors suffer heavy losses." The Rishi then took his leave, the sound of his wooden sandals on the marble floor echoing through the chamber. Dhritarashtra sighed repeatedly as Sanjaya began to describe what was happening at Kurukshetra. On the battlefield, Yudhisthira spoke with Arjuna. "In comparison to the enemy, our troops are few. In such cases, Brihaspati has recommended the needle formation. Quickly array our forces in this way, O Dhananjaya, or in any other way you see fit." Arjuna stood before his brother, clothed from head to foot in impenetrable armor. In his hands he held a gandiva, which gave off an iridescent glow. Nearby stood his fire-colored chariot, with Krishna holding the reins of his pure white horses. He looked at Yudhisthira, who shone in his own brilliant armor and jeweled helmet. "I will arrange our forces in the unassailable Vajra formation, which Indra designed. I will station Bhima at the head. Simply upon seeing him, the enemy will flee like so many terrified animals seeing a lion. There is no man who can even cast his eye on Vrikadar when he is enraged. He will be our shelter, as Indra is the shelter of the celestials." Arjuna mounted his chariot and set out to make the arrangement. The leading chariot divisions moved quickly forward and formed themselves into a long point, with Bhima, Drishtadyumna, Nakula, Sahadev, and Jataketu at its head. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers, wielding swords, spears, and axes, accompanied those generals. Flanked by great elephants clad in steel armor, the army thundered forward. Behind the point, they opened out into a larger group, filled with horsemen and infantry. The formation was protected in the rear by Virata and his entire Akshahini of troops. Nakula and Sahadev guarded Bhima's left and right sides, while Abhimanyu and Draupadi's sons protected him from behind. Not far behind them came Sikandi, protected by Arjuna, and advancing with firm determination to kill Bhishma. Yudhisthira took up his position in the center of the army. He was protected all around by many chariot fighters, and he appeared like the sun surrounded by bright planets. The warrior standards rose above the troops like palm trees, decorated with gold and silver. Above them all was Arjuna's huge banner, with Hanuman at its top, shouting out his fearful battle cry. As the army advanced, Bhima whirled his mace and roared. He seemed to scorch the Kauravas by his glance. Even his own troops were afraid of him. Once the Pandava forces were arrayed, they stopped to await orders. The two commanders had yet to blow their conches before the fighting could begin. The Pandavas looked toward the eastern side of the battlefield, where the immense Kaurava army spread out across the entire horizon as far as the eye could see. A strong wind began to blow, carrying sharp stones and pebbles, and the sky thundered, although no clouds were visible. Meteors fell and the earth trembled. A thick cloud of dust rose and obscured the sun. Seeing the Pandava's Vajra formation, Bhishma arrayed the Kaurava troops in a counter-formation. With his white headdress, white banner, white bow, and white umbrella over his head, he looked like a white mountain. Duryodhan rode in the midst of the army, riding an elephant the color of a blue lotus. Above his seat, a large white umbrella sheltered him. His great mace rested on his shoulder, and his bow was by his side. He was eulogized by bards and singers, and was protected by hundreds of thousands of troops. All of Dhritarashtra's sons were in the division under Bhishma's command and personal protection. Countless kings and princes from every part of the globe, surrounded by their armies, advanced toward the Pandavas. Behind all the troops came Drona, riding on a golden chariot, yoked with red horses. Gazing across at the Kaurava army, with Bhishma at their head, Yudhisthira again became apprehensive. He turned to Arjuna. O mighty armed hero, it seems to me that Bhishma has arranged his troops in an impenetrable formation. Nor do I see any possibility of overpowering the grandfather. He has limitless strength and unfading glory. Who can approach him in battle? How can victory be ours? Yudhisthira appeared disconsolate and dejected. Arjuna offered words of encouragement. Listen, O king, as I tell you how only a few men can overpower a vast army. Brihaspati explained this in days of yore when the celestials fought the demons. Those who desire victory do not conquer by prowess, but by truth, compassion, piety, and virtue. Fight with assurance, dear brother, for victory is always where righteousness is found. Yudhisthira still seemed doubtful. Was his cause even righteous? It seemed to him that his desire for the kingdom was at the root of this war. Arjuna, sensing his misgivings, continued, "We have Krishna on our side. He is righteousness and truth personified. Narada said that victory is certain to go to Krishna and whomever is on his side. Indeed, it is one of the Lord's eternal attributes. His might is infinite. He is the original person, beyond and above this mundane world, with all its politics and suffering. I do not see the cause for your sorrow when that Lord of the Celestials is on your side and wishing you success." Thinking of Krishna, Yudhisthira felt pacified. He looked at his troops. "It is exactly as you say, Arjuna. Krishna desires this conflict, and thus we should not hesitate. Tell our men to fight to the best of their power. with fairness and with the desire to attain heaven. Yudhishthira then distributed charity to the numerous Brahmins who had accompanied him onto the battlefield. He was surrounded by rishis who walked around him, chanting hymns in his praise and invoking auspiciousness for the battle. Having been given gold, cows, fruits, flowers, and cloth, they left the field, uttering prayers and Vedic mantras. Arjuna's chariot moved to the front of the army. Krishna said, "There stands the mighty hero among men, Bhishma, who has performed hundreds of sacrifices, who scorches his foes in battle, and who will soon attack our troops like a lion. Innumerable troops protect him as clouds cover the sun. Make him your target, Arjuna, for none other can face him." Krishna told Arjuna to offer a prayer to the goddess Durga so that she would empower him. Arjuna alighted from his chariot and knelt down with folded palms. With his face to the east, he chanted hymns from the Vedas to supplicate the powerful goddess of the material energy. As he prayed, the goddess appeared above him in the sky. "O son of Pandu, you will surely attain victory. You have the invincible Narayan to help you. No foe can defeat you, not even the mighty Indra." Durga vanished, and Arjuna rose to his feet. Considering himself blessed, he remounted his chariot with a joyful heart. Seeing that both armies were in position and waiting for the battle to begin, Bhishma raised his conch and sounded a great blast. At once the sounds of hundreds of other conches reverberated around the battlefield as all the leading warriors joined with him. Drums, bugles, trumpets, and horns were all suddenly sounded, creating a tumult. Arjuna and Krishna took out their conch shells. They blew long and mighty blasts that resounded across the battlefield. Bhima, the twins, and the other leading Pandava fighters also sounded their conch shells. Hearing the celestial sound, the Kauravas felt their hearts quake. But Bhishma was cheered. His eyes flooded with tears as he recognized the sound of Krishna's transcendental conch. Here was the eternal Lord of all the worlds, prepared to protect his devoted servants by personally coming into battle with them. Bhishma gazed across at Arjuna's chariot. It was cruel destiny that had brought him into opposition with Krishna and the Pandavas. Surely, duty was all-powerful.